Please go ahead. This afternoon's conference call is now being recorded.
Thank you ever so much, Tim. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everybody. This is the PPSAI Working Group call on the 25th of February 2014. On the call today, we have Steve Metalitz, Holly Raich, Sarah Wild, Libby Bainey, Tobias Sattler, Roy Baesti, Todd Williams, Don Blumenthal, Graham Bunton, Darcy Southwell, Christina Rosette, Luke Soifer, James Waddell, Jim Bykoff, Tim Ruiz, Griffin Barnett, Staten Hammock, Kathy Kleiman, Alex Deacon, Don Moody, and Justin Macy. We have apologies from Suzanne Prosser, Marie-Laure Lemineur, and Mary Wong. And from staff, we have Marika Koenigs, Amy Bivins, Mike Zupke, Joe Catapano, Terry Agnew, and myself, Natalie Peregrin. I'd like to remind you all to please state your names before speaking for transcription purposes. Thank you ever so much, and over to you, Don.
Appreciate it. I think we also had apologies from Maria Farrell. Just for the record. Well, welcome everybody to the second week of really substantive review of the of our work. So substantive portion of our work. We've kind of had a sense from some of the conversations that it'd be worthwhile doing some just practical view of the process that our policy is going to feed into. That's still early in development stages, but we decided to have staff to just discuss the registrar accreditation process as kind of a model that we'll be building toward. We may have some other similar programs later, but we'll start with this. So why don't I get out of the way and we can just dive right in. I'm not quite sure who's going to be doing the presentation, so whoever it is, take over.
Okay, thanks, Don. This is Mike Zupke from ICANN staff. Can you guys hear me okay? Sometimes I'm told that my headset isn't too good.
That's a very unusual complaint, but yeah, I've got you. All right.
Okay. So I'm the Director of Registrar Programs at ICANN, and I'll confess it's been a while since I've been the person who handled one of these accreditation applications from the very beginning to the very end, but at one point in my career at ICANN, that was my job, so I'll do my best to sort of give you a high-level overview. And then we've also got Amy Bivins with us, who has been more recently trained on some of these things, so I may have to defer to her for some specific questions if you've got some that I can't answer. But my understanding is that you guys thought it would be helpful to, sort of see how the registrar accreditation process works and maybe kind of use that as sort of a framework for thinking about how a proxy accreditation program might work. So without further ado, let me just kind of dive into this a little bit. So what you see on the screen is, a pretty thorough outline of the process that we follow. Starts, application comes in. We generally have those all come into a ticketing system, so the applicant gets a receipt notification that we've received their submission. There's typically a fee involved that obviously can't be submitted through a ticketing system. So that goes to our finance department, and so there's just a little bit of coordination on our part about making sure that the fee was paid. And the fee for the registrar accreditation application is $3,500. That was set by our board, and that was intended on a cost recovery model. That fee went up about maybe 2 years ago to cover the cost of enhanced background checks that we're now doing. So that's really that's sort of like the input part of this. And then we do some checks to make sure that the application is complete. We submit the name of the company and the principals against the OFAC list, which is the Office of Foreign Assets Control. And that's to make sure that, ICANN is legally able to receive money from that organization or from those entities. And I don't think it's happened where we've had to reject somebody. I think we had one issue where an applicant was on the list and they withdrew. But theoretically, that's not a showstopper. If your country is on the list, there's a process, I guess, by which ICANN could request approval or an exception to do business. Obviously, if you're a known terrorist, that's probably not going to be granted. But You know, I'm not an expert in this, but I understand there can be grounds for exceptions there. So we do the, you know, really the second step is initial review. What you see is, you know, sort of like getting all the paperwork in order and starting the processes that take a little bit longer. So if the registrar applicant is affiliated with some other registrars or perhaps a registry, we would ask our compliance team to perform a status, to provide a status report on the existing entity. If there are documents that we need to have translated or if we just need some interpretation of something, we'll submit those right away. You know, basically trying to get any of the more time-consuming things kind of in the pipeline first. And then, like I said, we just check to make sure the application is complete. When it's complete, then that's when we can begin the sort of more detailed review. And so the purpose of the really of the detailed review is to ensure that this applicant will be able to comply with the policies that ICANN has in place and ensure that there is going to be some operational stability there. So we take a look at their technology. We take a look at their business plan. We take a look at their continuity planning. All those things are part of the application questions. And I think a couple weeks ago you may have seen I posted a link to the Statement of Registrar Accreditation Policy, and I'll share that again here when I'm done talking. And that's really where all of these things come from. Let's see what else. So we do at ICANN, we do some searching on the company and on the applicant principals to make sure that there's not a history of consumer complaints or trademark complaints, that sort of thing. And then in the case of an entity that's not known to us, in other words, not already a contracted party, we would typically also submit that to a third party for additional background checks, and that generally takes a couple weeks. So, you know, we try to be pretty thorough in the background checking that we do. And so, you know, this process actually, it sounds pretty straightforward, but there's quite a bit of back and forth that happens in this. Typically, you know, we'll take a look at the applicant's registration agreement, and we may have questions about that. We may see areas where we say, this doesn't comply with ICANN policy, or this might not comply with the policy. Can you explain it? And so sometimes this results in revision to the registration agreement, and sometimes it just results in clarifications by the applicant to ICANN. So assuming everything checks out, the person who's reviewing the application writes a memo, submits it to the Senior Director of Registrar Relations, who would either approve it, who could reject it, who could set it back with more questions for the applicant, or could grant the conditional approval. And that might be the case where the applicant says, I can get insurance, here's the proof that I can get it, and then, but they don't want to actually obtain a policy until they're approved, so that would be a conditional approval. So that's kind of the, that's sort of the beginning to the end of the application, and then from there is really sort of the, when the onboarding begins, and that's the applicant, or our finance department generates invoice for first year's fee. We generate a contract, and typically we do that by electronic signature unless there's a reason why the registrar couldn't. We require the applicant to begin a relationship with the escrow agent at the same time they sign their registrar accreditation agreement. So that's a fairly somewhat new development within the last couple of years. And then there's a welcome packet. So we send all these things to the applicant, and when they return a contract, we countersign it, and congratulations, you're a registrar. So that's sort of the high level, and I'm sure there's probably lots of questions and details in that. So if people have got questions, I'd be happy to try and answer.
Appreciate it, Mike. I should bring my mic down here so I can talk. No, thanks. Are there any questions? I'm kind of watching the chat on the side here. Okay. yeah. Thanks again. This was, again, just kind of an overview to get kind of a framework that we're building toward. We're doing the policy, but staff will be doing the details of how this all works. So
So
just some background information.
A little bit. Oh, sorry. I took a look at this, and I know it might be a little bit early for this group, but I tried to take this and turn it into something that might kind of make sense for a privacy or proxy service. If you like, I'd be happy to share that with you.
Yes, I'm off mute now. Yes, I appreciate that. Definitely something to take a look at and talk about later.
Okay.
Should we move on into the substance? The discussion of the templates for last week's central question and then getting us started on today's B1? Now, bring document up, please. Okay, there we are. Marika, could you kind of take us through the changes since last week?
Sure. So this is Marika. So basically what I did, I tried to capture some of the comments and suggestions that were made during last week's meeting. For one, starting with including some of the links to the information sources that I included there. Also providing some additional information on the privacy versus proxy numbers rating that we spoke about. Added as well the relevant information from the WHO's registrant in the identification study from May 2013. And then in the comments, I tried to capture basically some of the discussions or feedback that was received, first of all, on the specific comments that were submitted in response to the working group survey, and then also tried to summarize that into the new box that you see at the end, which we've added as well to the other templates that we'll be working on, in which we're basically trying to summarize or make a preliminary conclusion, and also included this box as was suggested on last call that we should talk about or make sure that we check whether similar conclusions apply to proxy services and privacy services, although in the specific questions it's probably not applicable. So maybe it's just helpful to read out the preliminary conclusions based on our conversation last week, which I said I tried to distill it from the conversation. So I've invited people before, if there are any comments or questions or proposed edits, feel free to suggest. So the preliminary conclusion for now reads, following an initial review of this question, the working group provisionally agrees that proxy and privacy services could potentially be treated the same way for the purpose of the accreditation process. However, further review of this question will be required following the outcome of the discussion on some of the other charter questions, which would determine whether different requirements should apply to proxy and privacy services, which may influence the response to this specific question. And that's all.
Yeah. I was just typing in the chat section. Any comments or questions on what Maria sent out, Maria and Mary sent out yesterday? I forget who the message actually came from. Any issue with the conclusions that were summarized from our conversation? Kathy?
Yeah. Did I hear correctly that we've got a tentative conclusion that proxy and privacy services should be treated the same? Because if I did, I thought there was some debate on that issue and that we were actually keeping it open and we're going to ask. I think Steve had offered the constructive conclusion that as part of every question that we ask, we ask whether every future substantive question, we kind of also ask, would this be different for proxy versus privacy? So I wanted to share that. I don't think we have a conclusion on that now. The other question I wanted to raise, Don, is is whether we want to look a little more closely at privacy services and proxy services and actually put some examples before the working group, because I'm beginning to understand that there's more of a spectrum than I thought. At least, you know, in the Who is Review team, I kind of thought there were proxy services and privacy services, and I thought I knew what they were, but I think there are more variations out there than I thought. And as we launch into differentiation and looking at these services, I think it might be useful to explore what people are actually doing, what it looks like, so that we can deal with the real world, not whatever world we think is out there.
What a concept. I think what Marika suggested is pretty much what you said in point one, that we... Last week's consensus was there isn't any specific reason to treat them differently, but we will continually review. It still is open on privacy versus proxy. Steve?
Yeah, this is Steve Metalitz. I agree with Don with what you just said on that question. And on the other point that Kathy raised, as I understand it, on next week's meeting, we're planning to get some presentations from some entities that are currently providing these services, and I think it would be good if I don't know exactly how those people are being identified or are volunteering to give those presentations, but I think it would be good if that includes both at least one privacy service as that's defined and one proxy service, so that people can be exposed to both of those. If that's possible, I would support that.
Yeah, I have a couple of feelers out. To be honest, I know more people in the proxy business than I do in the privacy business. So, any suggestions for people who could talk about these issues, talk about what Kathy discussed here, very very welcome. Marika?
Yeah, this is Marika. Just a note as well that in preparation for our call next week, we'll also be sharing some of the preliminary research we've done and looking at some of the terms and conditions we've obtained from some of the affiliated privacy proxy services with 2013 accredited registrars. And there as well, I think we'll try to draw some conclusions from that as well on differences and similarities. But one of the things we at least encounter as well, that even though certain services may be called privacy service, when you actually look what they do, they're actually proxy service, and probably vice versa that applies as well. So, one thing maybe indeed to look back at the definitions and how we apply those, and then indeed look at how services are offered or what the conditions of service are, and those may help define and where a certain service actually fits, because the title may not always be correct, or at least in line with what the definition is that we've been using as currently under the 2013 RAA.
Which may fit nicely into our next discussion about labeling privacy and proxy during the process. James?
Hi, thanks, Steve. James speaking, and I think Marika's point about, she's giving us a sneak preview of staff's research is one of the primary reasons why I support having sort of a generic definition or not treating these different types of services differently, because, I think it's important that these firms be able to modify their service delivery practices down the road and possibly even launch new services without having to check against ICANN to make sure that they haven't crossed some line and, we used to be a privacy service, now we're a proxy service, and vice versa. So I think that while I think that it is interesting that there are some key distinctions, unless we have a compelling reason to treat them differently, I strongly urge us not to start drawing arbitrary category boundaries and baking that into an ICANN policy for exactly the reason that Marika pointed out. Thanks.
Yeah, interesting point. I need to stop hesitating to think. I just opened up a lot of cheap shots. I understand that. Any other thoughts on this topic, or should we go on to the next? Okay, excellent. I think we're generally in agreement on where we should be going, or at least how to handle. I think on the last topic, it's just we're keeping it open and we'll keep looking at it. Okay. The next topic we were going to look at is the one that you should see on the screen before you, or hopefully you, if you're not on Adobe Connect, have the document that went out yesterday. Again, it should there be some kind of labeling of who is entries to show that there's been that registration is through a privacy or a proxy service. The different WHOIS studies have looked at how these identifications have been made. But the question is how many of those should be formalized, if anything should be formalized, or should we come up with something completely different? But I think there's a threshold question on, for lack of a better term, feasibility that Steve raised in email yesterday and is in the notes sidebar. So why don't I step back and ask Steve to lead that piece. I don't think Michaeli is on the call. No. But Steve, if you could at least explore what you sent out yesterday.
Yes, thank you. This is Steve Metalitz. I was just responding to something Michaeli had pointed out on the list a few weeks ago, and that is the way this question is phrased, it sounds as though privacy proxy service providers control WHOIS entries, and I think literally speaking that is not true. But they do, like any other registrant, they would submit information that would then be would find its way into the WHOIS records. So, but clearly the registrar and or registry would control those. So I think looking back to the WHOIS review team final report, which is on the screen, it seems clear that they weren't actually necessarily saying who is responsible for this, but to make sure that WHOIS entries were clearly labeled to indicate that registrations have been made by a privacy or proxy service. And I think that I guess I would support that conclusion, and obviously there's a number of ways this could be done, but I think as far as accreditation is concerned, our focus should be on what information is provided at the time of registration in a proxy service. What information is provided to the registrar, proxy service or privacy service. And I think that should clearly show that it's a privacy or proxy registration. And if you look at what's on the screen under background information, you see that in the previous studies that were undertaken, there are actually differing definitions, and it's possible that that some would have been missed or could have been over-inclusive. So I think it is useful to have this requirement that the service put something in those entries to make it clear that it's a privacy or proxy registration, and therefore people who are later accessing WHOIS will know that, and will know that if they have a problem, they can proceed according to the other steps in the accreditation process to try to either get a message to the true registrant through relay or try to find out who and where the true registrant is through some kind of reveal process if they meet the requirements for that. So I guess I would simply suggest that we could probably keep this at a fairly high level of generality and simply say that as I said in the note, that one accreditation requirement would be for the service to ensure that the contact information they submit to the registrar for inclusion in WHOIS clearly reflects the status as a privacy or proxy registration. Thank you.
Donna, are you on mute again?
Hello.
Thank you. Yeah, there's a trigger point. The mute trigger point is right near my elbow. I got to figure out how to hang it differently. Well, again, are there any other? I see Libby typed in there. Let me jump back to James' point, since nobody else is stepping in. Or wait, I'm sorry, Stephanie?
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Good, thanks. This may be a really stupid question, but I'm a little confused. If we go with the earlier comment that there shouldn't be a distinction at this point, at least, between a privacy and a proxy and any of the other variants in between, then isn't it a bit confusing to label whether the registration has been done by a privacy or proxy service from an accountability perspective? Because it seems to me there's a big difference between whether something is a proxy, in which case you're dealing with the guy who's responsible, the proxy, and you don't need to have that label, or if it's a privacy, just exactly how much accountability is the registrar taking. In other words, if we're going to agree that we're not going to distinguish between the services, then we can't agree to mark the registry because it'll be different. Or otherwise, it could be I'm just not understanding it. Anyway, that's the point I wanted to make.
Yeah, thanks. I see what you mean. James?
Hi, Don. James speaking, and maybe I can help clear this up, Stephanie. So I'm not saying at this stage in the game that we should not have different policies. I just wanted to point out that it would be very, very difficult in practice to have separate policies, and I think the bar should be extremely high for us to bifurcate our recommendations for privacy services versus proxy services, and we should have a really compelling reason to do so. I think this is easily solved by some sort of conditional recommendation, which is that, you know, either insert the registrant's identification into the who is registrant field, or you indicate that you are doing so on behalf of someone else. I think it's easily solved with the implementation language of the process that gives the service provider a choice without kind of cementing their feet into one box or another. They can essentially say, I'm following this model, so therefore I have these obligations, but if I ever change to a different model, I will have different obligations.
Yep, appreciate that, James. I was part of what got muffled when I hit the button was that I was wondering how the point fed back into your issue of feasibility of separating the categories. And I just want to raise one other point on top of what Stephanie mentioned. You know, certainly accountability is a piece of it, but to what extent do we have to think about these services should be labeled as a flag as to whether the registration information that's being seen is for the registrant or not, separate from the accountability issue. Marika?
Yeah, this is Marika. I'm just trying to capture some of the notes and comments made. So I had a question of clarification in relation to James's suggestion. So, James, are you suggesting that when the privacy proxy service submits the details to the registrar and indeed clarifies that it's on behalf of someone else, does then the registrar basically mark it in that way in who is, or there's a way that it's visible there? Was that what you were suggesting, or did I misunderstand?
No, I don't think, I'm sorry to just jump the queue here, but to respond to Marika, I don't think that's necessary at all. I think that there's sufficient I think that just building some standardizations or some uniform data submission guidelines or requirements around the privacy proxy service, I think the registrar just becomes a pass-through at that point, making sure that the format is acceptable and appropriate is really up to up to the service, and is really their accreditation is on the line, not the registrar.
Okay, thank you.
Great, Kathy?
Thanks, Don. Excuse me, I hope I'm off mute.
Yep.
I like what James is saying. It wasn't what I had been thinking of, and let me point out in the chat room, James posted what might go into the WHOIS, which would be the service name, presumably of the proxy privacy, comma, on behalf of customer, and then some kind of customer number or identifier. This is interesting because, of course, I've been thinking, flagging proxy or privacy, but I like it this way. It does leave open different possibilities, perhaps some business, models we haven't even thought about yet. But it serves the purpose in very general language. It serves exactly the purpose of flagging to the public, flagging to anyone who looks at the WHOIS, that this name is being managed or worked with on behalf of someone else. So I really like that. I think it kind of elegantly serves the purpose. So thanks to James.
Excellent. Agreement's always good. Stephanie, real quickly, is that your old hand or a new one?
Old hand, sorry.
No, it's okay. It's common, which is why we have to ask. Anything else to add to this discussion? Or do we have enough to move forward and at least write up a general direction that the discussion has gone? Oh, and to James' point, if just as a general ground rule, at least for these calls, I think if somebody is specifically asked a question, I don't think there's an issue of jumping the queue. No need to apologize. Are there any objections to moving on to the next question? Although we will be hampered by the fact that today's been a really efficient call. So we didn't distribute any materials concerning the next item.
This is Marika. I think we did share it. We just didn't add it to the agenda as we didn't anticipate moving so quickly through these, I think.
I apologize. You're absolutely right. I only pulled up two documents. Or didn't pull up all the documents, rather. Just a second. And that time I couldn't find the mute button, even though I wanted it. The question says it all. I mean, to what extent are we going to suggest that providers do checks of customer information in the sense, along the lines of expectations from over the years concerning registrars? Marika?
That is Marika. Maybe just to provide a little introduction to the information that's currently included here. And again, if people have additional background information that they think is relevant to this question, please feel free to share. So it includes some information from the Interal final report on Relay and Rebuild services, talking as well about the quality of registrant data, as well as a draft report for the study of the accuracy of who is registrant contact information, which even included some nice graphics. It also includes a reference from the WHOIS review team final report, who also suggests that the conducting of periodic due diligence checks on customer contact information should be considered. And then I also included the current language from the 2013 RIA in relation to the WHOIS accuracy program specification, as that was referred to as a possible example or model to look at. That was one of the sub-questions that was identified by the working group, which basically reads, how would such checks be conducted and to what level? Example giving, following the levels of validation and verification set out in the 2013 RIA or some other level. The full language of the RIA section is included in the annex to this to the document. And then it also includes the comments, and several of them are quite detailed or make specific suggestions on how such verification may take place that have been included as the comments in this in the table below, basically.
Great. Thanks for the summary. Kathy?
Yeah, thanks, Don. So let me pose a question out there, which is, as a baseline, why wouldn't we use the WHOIS accuracy program specification, which is part of the 2013 RAA? Why would we go below that? Why would we go above that? It seems to, looking at, emails and telephone numbers, this seems to be, the right baseline. I'd love to hear people's thoughts on that. Thanks.
So would I. Steve?
Yeah, this is Steve Michalitz. And I apologize because I'm going to have to drop off the call before it's over. But I did want to say I'm fine with using it as a starting point, but I think there's a very strong case to be made that the verification requirement should be much stronger in the case of these services. First of all, these are services. I'm looking ahead to the reveal situation. These are services where the information about the actual registrant, the customer of the service, is not going to be available as quickly as it is in WHOIS for a non-proxy registrant. So there's some built-in delay factor. When we get to reveal, we'll have to discuss how much of a delay that's going to be. But for that reason, I think it's even more important that once you get to the information, you have some greater assurance that it is accurate. And I think the experience of WHOIS users now in dealing with some of the existing privacy or proxy services is that once they do gain access to that information, it's very often inaccurate and or out of date. This is an additional service. This is not a registration service, and someone who wants this service would have to qualify or meet whatever the requirements that are set down for the service. And I think having greater requirements to provide or extensive requirements to keep your information accurate and up to date is a reasonable duty to assign to the customer in this case. So I'm not really prepared to have a full discussion of this since it wasn't on the agenda this morning, but I think my view is that we probably should be looking at heightened requirements for verification, validation of this data than we do have in the 2013 RAA for non-proxy registrants. Thank you.
Thanks. Volker?
Naturally, I disagree.
Okay.
I do not see how data that has been verified once, why it should be re-verified regularly if there is no reason to believe that it has become incorrect. That's added costs, added hassle, added administrative efforts, added development costs. That's probably unnecessary. Secondly, I don't remember where it was, but I've seen studies that seem to indicate that the accuracy of data used in WHO's privacy services as underlying data was much more accurate than the data that was available in the public WHOIS. So based on the fact that it's hidden and that people do not have to fear that their private data is in the public, they tend to give better data to privacy services, or when privacy services are enabled, than when domain names are registered directly without a privacy service. So that's something that we should bear in mind. I'm trying to figure out where it was, but I can't remember it off the top of my head. I have to look into that, where that was. Essentially, I think that the regulations that we have in place for registrars for checking the data should be sufficient for privacy providers as well.
Yeah, Volker, we appreciate what you just said about finding a citation. Just curious if when you're saying privacy service, is that specifically privacy or just a generic reference to privacy and proxy?
I'm not making that differentiation at this time, no.
Okay, great. Thanks. James?
Hi, Don. Thanks. James speaking. So I also would support Volker's comments and disagree that we should have more strenuous verification requirements than we have for currently for registrars, because the idea that we would expand upon the verification requirements in the 2013 RIA presumes that the latter or that those are actually working. And I can tell you that we are registrars as a community are really struggling to make this work and to clean up the millions of false positives that are currently being generated by the new requirements. And it's going to be a period of transition. So before we go about taking that further and making those into new requirements, let's get better at the existing requirements and let's get the ecosystem educated on what they have to do before they start, under penalty of losing their domain name, because I don't think that that's clear. Now, granted, it's only been live for, you know, a couple months now, but I can tell you that we are off to a rough start, and I would hate to start building any new requirements using the 2013 verification processes as a foundation. Thank you.
Appreciate it. Just to clarify, false positive, do you mean registrations that showed up as bad that in fact were good, or reverse?
I can just say that a lot of situations where these new requirements are tripping up just routine updates to WHOIS contact information, because we are dealing with such large numbers and we're dealing with such rapid updates that we have to, registrars are forced to automate these as best they can, and of course all automated systems will leave some folks out in the dark. So, of course, all of those edge cases need to be funneled to some sort of human customer service infrastructure. So we're really struggling with some of these, the implementation of the 2013 RIA, and making sure that the expectations are set and understood out there in the user community. Believe it or not, most people who do this don't follow ICANN PDPs for hobby, and are not aware of the implications of what their obligations are as registrants. And so I think it's going to take some time to get these things percolated out through the industry, and I'm not really sure that those systems and those requirements are mature enough yet to start expanding upon them. Maybe that'll be true once this PDP starts to – maybe we'll be in a better place once we get to the end of this PDP. But I can tell you that's sort of the feel now amongst the registrar community. Thanks.
Okay. Appreciate that. That's helpful. Kathy?
First, I wanted to comment on James's comment that everyone's not following ICANN PDPs. I can't believe that. I think the whole world follows everything, you know, closely. Regarding the studies, on whether people provide more accurate information if it's private? The answer is yes. At least one study was presented to the WHO's review team. And, Don, I wanted to ask if staff might be able to pull it. It was a Nominet study that I believe it was Nominet some time ago that looked at data that was protected, shielded, in Nominet's case, individual data, versus data that was posted publicly. And I think they did a research study on this and came up with the conclusion with conclusions that would be valuable to this working group. So I wanted to know if we could ask staff to find that, and if there's any problem, I'll be happy to help you with that. And other CCTLDs might have looked at something similar, so contacting Center or one of the other CCTLD organizations, this has been something of interest to them as well. So there might be other studies out there other than Nominet's that would be helpful to us as well.
Yeah. Good point. And I think we need to keep that in mind in general, that the GTLDs aren't alone in this, and there definitely are some good references to be called upon from the CC community, particularly I think Center and LACTLD, they're the most active of the associations. Any other comments here, or just for folks who have been following the chat, is there anything I might have missed that we should revisit? Marika?
Yeah, this is Marika. I'm just wondering whether it's worth going through the comments and seeing if there are any ideas or suggestions there that haven't been discussed or considered yet. So I'm assuming that we'll need to come back to this question next week to further consider this, but maybe that is helpful to see what ideas have been suggested there.
The comments in the chat or in the document?
In the document.
Okay. Yeah, I think it's for people on Adobe or who have the document, it's page 4, where the comments section begins.
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah. You may have a better handle on the wording here, since I think you wrote it in such a way that you could just do a fast summary rather than have me... read it out. Just reading the questions will kill the rest of our time.
Yeah, this is Rick. I actually didn't write it. I just basically copy-pasted what people submitted. But most or
yeah,
several of the commenters... I did that very efficiently, I think. several of the commenters agree that there should be a requirement to, at a minimum, verify email addresses and telephone numbers on an annual basis. I think the first commenter suggesting that could be set up in an automated way where people are receiving an email, or set up through a phone system where it's verified. And if that doesn't happen or there no verification takes place, additional notice is then provided, and that without verification, updated contact information to service would be terminated within a set period of time. I think the second comment is relatively similar in that regard. Also noting that there should be a re-verification or revalidation, especially when relay fails. That may be as well in relation to the conversation we have later on to see if that may be a trigger point potentially for, I guess, re-verification.
Third comment. Quick. No, I just want to jump in quickly and kick this back to, say, James or Volker. Is what's being suggested here much different from the current... the registrar processes?
This is James speaking, and I apologize, you caught me multitasking. What part of the language are we looking at specifically?
Okay. Sorry.
I think
it will be subject to a quiz at any time. You need to pay attention.
I think it is
different. I think it is different here. From looking at it, it requires definite annual verification in this comment, for example, and that's a very large difference from what it's currently what is currently in place for registrars. Registrars are required to verify the address once upon registration, and that's it. We are required to re-verify when we have any indication that there might be a problem with the data. There's different triggers that may trigger such a re-verification, but there's no set date when we have to re-verify, and I think that's fine and sufficient.
How about the information checking processes that are outlined here?
Let me read those again. This is where this is trying to get us back to phone and email, not acceptable.
Oh, yes, here we go.
That's right, the requirement is OR. Okay. Sorry, Marika, just wanted to...
The key distinction, yes, because again, I'm sorry, this is James speaking for the transcript. The key here, the difference is that one is very easy, or let's say not easy, but straightforward to automate, and one is not. And that is why I think providing registrars some latitude to develop that. I mean, some registrars, for example, serve customers face-to-face, and therefore are very it's very easy for them to verify certain information. Others have only a web-based relationship with their customers, and it becomes much more difficult.
Okay, thanks. Marika, sorry for cutting in there, but...
One comment I then notes as well that this is actually not necessary as the ICANN registrar is already achieving this. And I think then there are two more commenters that one saying that it should be the same process as for the new RAA. And the other one is saying that there should be additional safeguards in place to verify information so that the data can be revealed to third parties if needed.
Okay, that's the last one there.
Correct.
Maybe just one comment from my end. I mean, we're looking at privacy proxy services both affiliated with registrars and not affiliated with registrars. And I can see that there should be some verification for those that are not affiliated with registrars that ensure that the same verification level is achieved for those services that is required for those that are affiliated. However, those services that are already affiliated with registrars shouldn't be required to do an initial verification of the same data that the registrar has already verified in the registration process. So we might want to differentiate not in what kind of privacy proxy provider it is, but into ensuring that the same level of verification takes place. But make it clear that this only has to happen once, not once per provider that's involved in the registration process. Because looking at how registrants register, having to verify your who is privacy provider and your registrar is going to cause a lot of confusion again.
Okay. Interesting point. Let me just nail something down here. Now you're saying it'd be and maybe I'm just being dense here. Could you go a little further into how we're talking about double verification? Would the registrar be involved in checking registrant data in the case of privacy or proxy?
It could be. I mean, in cases where the privacy proxy service provider is affiliated with the registrar and just a contracted party of the registrar, then in all likelihood, the registrar will, under its obligations under the RAA, conduct the verification of the underlying data already. Whereas if the privacy proxy service provider is not affiliated with the registrar, then it would have to do that. But so when crafting that language, we might want to make sure that the privacy proxy service provider has to ensure that the data has been verified in that manner that is, for example, prescribed in the RA, which I would argue for as the correct process, and thereby either forcing him to do it himself, or if he has a personal knowledge contractual obligation that this data has already been verified by the registrar, then that should be sufficient for the privacy proxy provider as not to trigger his own verification again, because that would lead to double verification if registrar and privacy proxy service provider would have to do the same thing twice.
Right. Okay. I got it now. James?
Thanks, Don. James speaking. And I agree with Volker, and I would add that there's another scenario we should consider, which is that if someone decides not to renew the privacy service or it loses, you know, violates the terms of service somehow and loses that service, and we decide as the privacy service decides to, exchange their information with their underlying customer information in the WHOIS, that would trigger a re-verification on the registrar side as well if they're not affiliated. So we would need to have some indication that they were held to the same standard and that both the registrar side and the privacy service side would have confidence that the data was verified according to the same level of standards, and it would not be necessary to duplicate those efforts multiple times. So I think that what Volker is saying is correct, and it would actually provide some consistency for the relay and reveal process.
Okay, excellent. Marika?
Yeah, this is Marika. I just wanted to note that I think it was Paul in the chat noted that, you know, he was not aware that this was being covered this week, so I'm making sure that this comes back to the agenda for next week, and I think it's probably something that we'll point out as well on the list as we send out a revised version of this document. And wanted to suggest as well, it may be helpful, because I saw that some questions in the chat were submitted. For example, I think Val notes what types of activities would trigger a re-verification of customer data. Maybe some of the questions that have been raised here would be good to attach them to the templates and encourage people maybe to share their views on those aspects, so that will hopefully help us frame more of a conclusion than I think where we're currently at, and it will give people as well some time to think about it and digest the different views that have been expressed today. And as I said, I'll try to capture all the comments that you've made, but please, you know, if I get them wrong or anything is missing, you know, feel free to share it on the list so we can update that accordingly.
Yeah, appreciate it. Sorry about that, Paul. Like I said before, we kind of got a little bit efficient here, and I thought it'd be better to roll forward than just lose the 25 minutes, because I'm sure later on we'll have a few where we get bogged down. But we will revisit this topic at the beginning of the next call, or earlier in the next call anyway. In any event, it's just a little bit after 11 o'clock. As always, appreciate your time. And talk to everybody next week.
Thank you, Don.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, Don.
Thanks.
Don. Bye, all.